This is a continuation of 6th of March, the continuation of 6th of March from Channel 1 Right, from Channel 1 Right. Now this is Channel 1 Over.
I don't know, sometimes I think I'll just start reading Jesse Stewart. He's one of my friends. I like him very much. But he's not subtle, and he's not an artist like James. Now, you want to talk a little bit about that, the evil in it? Where is the evil? You're not justified in saying that, that he asserted his independence at school. You see, you don't see as much of that. I say, what did he do in the book, in the story, that shows what he did in school? Read through that again and again and again. That's the worst thing he did. That's about as bad as a boy can do, you see. And that's brought out with the housekeeper. And you know, I read this, and even after Mr. Lytle, he's a gifted man. He's almost like Henry James, you see. His mind is so complex. And he said the evil is unspecified. Well, it is in the letter. But in the story, it's not. It is specified. Well, lies. Well, don't you remember about that thing that came up with Peter Quint and Mrs. Groves? I tell you what, I don't remember this. You just look in that chapter where that's early in the book, where he brings that out. Let me tell you, I was going to talk to you about Poe this morning. Don't you want to talk about Poe? Huh? You had enough? Manuscript found in a bottle. Now that's his first story, one of his early stories. At the time he wrote that, he didn't know what he wanted to say, and he didn't know how to say it. And the easiest thing to do is to struggle with it and force a meaning into it, and there's not any in it. Now in that first paragraph, for instance, if we had time, I'd let you bring it out. I can run through it. For instance, in that first paragraph, he says, "Indeed, a strong relish for physical philosophy has, I fear, tinctured my mind with a very common error of this age. I mean the habit of referring occurrences, even the least susceptible of such reference, to the principles of that science. Upon the whole, no person could be less liable than myself to be led away from the severe precincts of truth by the ignorant fatui of superstition." Now, what he says there is that he has a scientific mind. Now, he doesn't use the word scientific. And what he's doing is preparing the reader there for what is to come, and bring some credibility, you see, to himself. Having no other inducement. Now look at that. But you see, he puts that in. My habits of rigid thoughts enable me to detect their falsity. You see, I don't know. He really hasn't said much now. And he goes on this journey in paragraph 2, having no other inducement than a kind of nervous restlessness. Now, for this journey, You don't have any idea where the journey's going to, do you? Unless you read it closer than you needed to, I don't think you would. Does anybody know where he's going? He doesn't mean to go there, but the ship has taken off its course. Why? Why? Where? Well, he even goes further than that, doesn't he? Doesn't he go down in the South Pole? You know why? Because that's a literary answer. Because the Ancient Mariner went down there. And he's read Coleridge. So he's one of the first, you see, to see that polar sea. But now, look, yes, Joe. Yeah.
That's exactly like the ancient mariner. It was too hot, and even how the thread of the air wouldn't move, and everybody was thirsty, and the animal
right.
Was too negative, just cold.
Yeah.
And the damage was tremendous.
Yeah. Well, now, you see, there's nothing simpler than for a young writer to bring forth something which is totally derivative. Now, but he ends that. That ends at the paragraph, we were at the bottom of one of these abysses. Now he forgets the polar part of it. And he just thinks of this huge ship coming down on him. That's got another story. And where he gets that, I don't know. Yeah, it looks a little like Hawthorne, except Hawthorne hadn't been written then. It looks like... well, you see, you want to... Let me see. Where is that? Let me talk with you a little minute now about the Cascamont Lotto. Have you got it? Yes. Here's the way to do it. Now, you see, if that was true, they would take this out of the curriculum. Unless you take it in a halfway civilized point of view, that Poe himself, you know, was a member of society. And what he's doing is pointing out to you, whenever you feel like you want to get it back on a fella, the utter horror of the idea of revenge. Then you haven't read the story. Now, I don't think many people who have read have read it. I'm ready to make contact with you. Yeah. Well, I don't know about that. He was just studying the man, you see. He studied the man in order to get revenge, and his weakness was with this particular one. That's all I know. Now, let me tell you, before we go, let me show you, if it helps at all to you. In the pit and the pendulum, I think you can see, if you just take my word for it, at least work from my suggestion. Yes, I'll have to read the beginning of that with you. If I can find it, the Pit and the Pendulum. Now, the very first page. Now, you see, I didn't find this out myself. I read this in Mr. Quinn's, Arthur Hobson Quinn's, fine book on Poe. And he called attention to this first paragraph.
This is the end of 6th of March. This is the end of 6th of March. The next to the last day of class. Now just starting on Poe. Isn't that awful? Now this is the last day of Emerson. This is Friday, the 8th of March, 1968. The last day of Emerson. And this is all my talk and very little discussion. And the first thing, I have to work out with them the examination, and it's the first time I ever waited until the very last day to work it out. I've always had it the last week or 10 days, so it would sink into their minds. Well, there's the bell, and it's right on time. Of course, my old watch. You know, I'm just beginning to be able to come in here and look forward to the discussion with you. I've been nervous a good part of the term. I guess when I'm nervous, I make you nervous. I want to talk to you a little bit first about the examination in case I get carried away like I did yesterday on that turn of the screw. The examination I give in almost every class is the same, broadly. And in this, it takes this form in two parts. The first part of it is sort of your part. And in that, I think of literature as what literature teaches. And in the second part, it's the same old thing you're used to in the literature courses. I'm just asking you objective questions, factual, informative questions about the literature. Now, you know, I'm more interested in the first. But if I neglected the second, or just minimized the second, they would fire me. And I think I would be doing you an injustice. In the first part, when I ask you what literature teaches, what you have learned, and what the literature wants you to learn, I think of it as pursuit. To venture amongst these writers and to make contact with them and to experience this world that they invite you to. It's almost applying what Whitman said to yourselves. Now, I'll pin this down. I won't leave it in general language. You flood yourselves, you see, with the immediate age, with these immediate world of these writers. Uninhibited, unhindered, as much as you can by society. By, now I'll break the term society down, by prepossessions in your mind about the writers. Now if you could set down these things and listen to, and you can if you put yourself to it, you see, you're just listening to me, and most of you in a daze, in a coma. You're not setting down things. To rise above your prepossessions about these writers and somehow overcome this idea we have now of a 40-hour week and cutting class on Friday. All of which, I think, hinders any pursuit of anything in this world in which we live. And these little things that I talk to you about, these newspaper meditations. This old idea we have about comparing characters and comparing authors. These logical analyses, logical. Well, you work it out logically, and it's always wrong. These diffuse, abstract discussions that seem to prevail on campuses, which simply obstruct. The writers can't penetrate that sort of thing. Your families. And what they do to you when you go home over Thanksgiving or Easter. What you think the elementary education department wants you to learn and teach.
for one thing, the theory that the child is subject, is responds only to what he sees. And that means he can't respond to Huckleberry Finn on the Mississippi River. He's never seen the Mississippi River. Those extraordinary notions, you see, that we get. Now, that's what I mean when I say, take your experiences term and think about it. Freed as much as you can from these obstructions of society. Now, let me be just a little bit more positive. The high points of the course, not of the course, but of the course as it exists in your mind. Now, in every case, whenever I had a perception, an illumination about the course, I would link it with something concrete. Now, we stayed for a long time on this one little instance of Hester as she appeared, as she emerged from the jail. That was almost a pivot of the course, because we argued about that back and forth. And then we, later information, we brought back to bear on that. So that inevitably you would have to use that incident. We worked on it so much. But now that's sort of public property. We all did that. And what I'm interested in are these little incidents and focus points that meant something to you privately, that we didn't make public property in the discussion. Now, I'll restate what I said. In the first part of your first hour, say, of your examination, and you've got the question now, I won't even have to repeat it in the examination. When you come in here on Thursday, we'll get to that in a minute. I just said here, unhindered by these little hindrances, to set down your own perceptions as they have come to you as you look back over your reading and our talk this term. And your make them all concrete. Link them with an incident like Hester emerging from the jail. Let me talk just a minute. Now, you see, the course itself unfolds. We start in a negative way with prudence. First, we read an application of it in the autobiography, and then we use that little analysis of it in the Poor Richard Way to Wealth. And Thoreau picks that up as his stepping stone, as his bouncing off place, what do you call it? Teeing off place. Springboard. For Walden. The first 50-100 pages, 50 pages or so, of Walden uses Poor Richard and Franklin and the idea of prudence as his springboard. Now, Thoreau does it in a curious way. Unexpected way, but he does it in that creative way that comes from that Emersonian view. He doesn't deny prudence, but he says he himself, with his viewpoint, his Emersonian viewpoint, can be more prudent than Franklin. And from what I know about the two, he is more prudent, actually, than Franklin. Now, you see, the course unfolds. It's just a succession of flights and drops, except I don't think we have so many drops. It's little flights, you see? Little illuminations where the material comes to you. Thank you.
Now, I might break that up, that first hour, and ask you partly to take one of the Emersonian points and just sort of handle that for a few minutes. Like he says, you see, that logic doesn't convince. I don't know whether you could handle that or not. A lot of these things you kind of understand, but they don't work out well. You can't write about them. One of the last ones, you see, we got was his treatment of art. Whitman's treatment of art. That was in that little passage that I asked you about on the exam, on your last test. These concrete forms, you see, by which my meanings are tied down. And those vast lists of concrete incidents that he gets from reading the newspapers and flooding himself with the life of this immediate age that he puts in and minimizes, you see, the ideas, the abstract ideas, he minimizes them. And he goes so much farther than Emerson in that. You see, that's what makes Emerson hard to read. He won't submit to an orderly process of thought. Now, I'd like for you to take one of those little points. You could take prudence. You could take an institution, how an institution stops the thought, not so much as an example in your own experience as what they say about it. You see, your outstanding example of that is Dimmesdale. Hawthorne won't let him get off the ground for a long time. His thought, you see, is bound, hemmed in by the institution. Oh, you know, as I think about it, if we could just stay together for just a little longer. You see, we've got the terms now. We've got categories in which to think, which are valid. And we could pursue those. We don't have to use these writers. We could use Faulkner, Mark Twain. It doesn't matter. We could use any of them and pursue these same points. And it would just be no end of good. Me too, you see. I haven't been much farther than you have. So much farther. You see, what I was thinking of, you talk about society, and society, as you use it, is sort of a limp word, limp term. You think you know what it means. You talk about prudence, you see, but Poor Richard's got a better idea of prudence than you have. And then when I think about Poor Richard's idea of prudence then and my idea about prudence now, I think about how dull my idea is, incomplete, indecisive. And we could work those things out so that what we're doing is leaving this sort of half-baked. Not with light on the subject, with just a glimmer. So that the institution, you see, is scotching us. About the time the institution enables us to get a start, the institution scotches us. You know, one of the greatest mistakes I ever made in my life was in a class like this, not exactly this one, but I tried in the next class, come in with me, in the next class, say, like, you know, if I were to have this class next term, I start off with that next class just where we left now. You know what they'd do? Oh, it would be terrible. You see, the assumptions we make are so far along, so advanced, that they would be simply bewildered. Oh, it is. You find that out if you haven't found it out already. It would just be painful. Why, they would revolt. I've had them revolt on me a whole class. I have that happen every now and then. Except I hold them. I still hold them, and they've got to come, even though they ever one of them in their revolts. I won't let them get away with it. At the same time, I know that I have blundered, and they have closed their mind to me. But now, you see, we have gone along this long. Well, you see, I'm wandering now. Now, in the second part, it would be just the usual kind of questions. I would say to you, tell me exactly what is the evil that Miles committed in school as it is acted out in this story. I see, I just picked it up from last time. That'd be a marvelous fine question. because it comes right from the discussion. Now, isn't that a good English question? I think it is. I believe you could handle that. And another one. Now, these are particular questions or particular sections. I'd say in Walden now, what did Thoreau learn from his experience with beans? Well, now you say that's not fair. It wouldn't be fair if I expect you to just know everything he said. But I don't think anybody can read the thing without remembering a little something about his experience with beans. It all takes place in one place. No, it's sort of divided. It's mostly in one place. Now, that's the examination. What do you want to bring up? Talk about your opinion. I don't deal in opinions in this. Well, that's that Emersonian inquiry where the light comes to you. Where you understand every now and then. It just comes to you. Now, you're trying to take my language into your language. And after a couple of months of my language, I think you ought to adapt yourself to mine. With you. How they relate to Emerson, I can't just say right offhand. I'd be glad to if I could. Yes. I can't very well do that. I'd like to, but I can't very well do it. Thank you, sir. I can't very well ask you questions about material we haven't covered, at least gone through in class. Oh, of course. Yes, oh, of course. I despise blue books. You can use a blue book if it helps you. I'll try. Just have it in your mind. Not before you get that. Think about it. Now, let me tell you. You know what you can do? You can learn more about this reading between now and examination and almost than you have during the course. I mean, the things will come to you. And you may have more consecutive time for it where you're not interrupted by all these class meetings. Yeah. You don't have to limit to one unless I ask you to. I might just pick out one and ask you, or give you a choice and ask you to do that. I think maybe I ought to do that. Give you let you work with that 15, 20 minutes. You see, that's good for your mind. And then you don't think about this comparison of characters, you know. It sort of forces you out of your high school attitudes. That we all have, of course. I think of that sometimes as almost that first part, you see, is sort of a choice of attitude. Whether you're going to allow yourself to have new views of a subject, or every time you get a little new view of it, you think about it as a disappointment that your old view has been wrong. And it's a blow to your Freudian self. To me, I just can't. Somehow that just leaves me perfectly cold. That any new light on a subject would be disappointing to a person. I just can't see that. But I know you feel it sometimes. So I'm not denying evil, as Emerson tried to do. Limited. Look, I don't think anybody could get this pit in the pendulum without a little help. And I told you last time where I got it. Mr. Quinn, in that long, fine book on Poe, is not very readable. It's a sort of source book. Called attention to it. And what he says in this, now let me tell you, last time I told you about the Castle Montelardo, that is a orderly graduate study, you might say. It's an abstract study of the idea of revenge.
And he gives you a concrete case of how utterly destructive the whole idea of revenge can be. Now that makes Poe an artist of the first order. He's not playing with people, he's trying to instruct them. Now in this, he has the same thing. He does the same thing. He sets forth his thesis at the beginning. I never would catch it. Now let me show you how he does it. He pictures himself as a victim of the Inquisition. I wish, you see, he hadn't made it historical like that, because this makes it a little more hard, difficult to read. Where he's at the trial, and the judges have brought in their sentence, and he has been worked over, you see, to the point where his physical energies are hardly sufficient to keep the little glimmer of light in his mind. And the second paragraph, he analyzes what happened. And the question he raises is, you see, what is it with utter physical exhaustion and punishment at all keeps the mind alert? Now you look at how he does it. I was sickened to death with that long agony, and about that time your mind stops working. I say yours, mine does too. And when they at length unbound me and I was permitted to sit, I felt that my senses were leaving me. Now that's it. That's almost like the governess's first sentence. That whole experience, she says, as she looks back at it, was a series of flights and drops of the right throbs and the wrong. Just those stages that we call anxiety. The sentence, the dread sentence of death, was the last of distinct accentuation which reached my ears. After that, the sound of the inquisitorial voices seemed merged in one dreamy, indeterminate hum. It conveyed, now here he's looking at it and analyzing it as the governess looks back at the experience of that disquieting faculty of hers and analyzes it. It conveyed to my soul the idea of revolution turning around, perhaps from its association fancy with the blur of a mill wheel. I don't follow him on this. Partly because my mind cuts off. I don't want to follow it. My mind doesn't have his vigor, you see. This only for a brief period, for presently I heard no more. Yet for a while I saw, now I can follow this, but with how terrible an exaggeration, I saw the lips of the black-robed judges. The lips of the black-robed judges. They appeared to me white, whiter than the sheet upon which I traced these words, and thin, even to grotesqueness, thin with the intensity of their expression of firmness. I saw them writhe with their locution. I saw them fashion the syllables of my name. I shuddered and so forth. I saw too, from a few moments of glorious horror, the soft and nearly imperceptible waving of the draperies. And then my vision fell upon the seven tall candles on the table. Now you see, his mind is passing into unconsciousness. And this is all that he can remember and recapture. At first, these seven tall candles wore the aspect of charity and seemed white, slender angels who would save me. And then all at once there came the deadly nausea over my spirit, and I felt every fiber of my frame thrill as if I touched an electric battery while the angel and so forth. And then there stole into my fancy like a rich musical note, and you can follow the details of it, and he swoons. He loses consciousness. And in the second paragraph, he says what happens.
minds, but still will not see that all consciousness was lost. What of it there remained, I will not attempt to define, even describe, yet all was not lost in the deepest slumber, in delirium. No, in death itself, consciousness cannot be utterly lost. Now, that's one of those Emersonian perceptions that comes to him from this, you see, and aroused from the most profound slumbers. You see, he's kind of working it out in his mind now. And then as you come to life again, he says you have two stages. First, the mind becomes a little bit alert, but the body is still impassive. And then the body moves, and as he works it out in the story, he puts his hand out to see where he is. But as we read that story, we have no more conception of that thesis than a peanut. We think of that pit. In the confusion attending my fall, I did not immediately apprehend the somewhat startling circumstances, which yet in a few minutes afterwards and while I lay prostrate arrested my attention. It was this: my chin rested upon the floor of the prison, but my lips, with the upper portion of my head, although seemingly at a less elevation from the chin, touched nothing. At the same time, my forehead seemed bathed in a clammy vapor and the peculiar smell of the decayed fungus. I put my arm forward, you see, and there's nothing there. And that pit takes over the story. You see, you lose contact with Poole on account of that pit that he brings up. Now, where is that pendulum? Yeah, down, certainly, relentlessly down. It vibrated with 3 inches of my bosom. I struggled violently, furiously to free my left arm. And you see that relentless pendulum. And you see what it is. You see the pendulum in the pit, but you don't see the man. You quit seeing the man. So the struggle that Poole is tracing in here of how the mind, the consciousness, survives these terrible ordeals, or any extremity, actually. He's inquiring the same thing the others are, just how much the individual will stand up in the face of adversity. It's almost the same as Moby Dick. But the individual won't stand up in the face of the pit and the pendulum as we read about it. You see, the individual gives way. All our mental powers succumb. And then we're disappointed. We think that our childish reading of this saying it ought to be true. And we resent any new light on the subject. We want to keep Poole the way he was when we were 12 years old. I think it's nice to reread Poe, any of these writers. The image comes up so clearly of what he was when we first read him. The most dramatic time I ever saw that was when I was invited as a sort of plum. It was offered me as a plum to teach Shakespeare at one term. I was in a new school. I was overcome. I'd never taught Shakespeare. That's about all I did. I have no recollections of what happened that first half year on that new campus, except Shakespeare. I found out I didn't know enough about Shakespeare to talk about him, much less teach him. So I just read and read and read. And you know what? In every play I had, there was my old notes. And I tell you, it just destroyed my personality to think that I ever thought some of the things that I had wrote in the margin there. Well, I guess it is a little bit hard on the personality just to see those old positions. I don't know that I ever
lectured. I'm lecturing, I guess, now. I'm doing the talking. I don't know that I ever lectured before on pole. All I have ever done that I can remember is just read him and talk and let the other people bring up their own viewers as they see them. If you have time, and if you're where the air is fluid, you see, and you don't have to combat your neighbors who are coming in to talk, and all those things, all these things come to you. You don't have to be told what I'm telling you. I could give you a few little leads. You do the rest. But better than I can. You see, in a way, I'm closing the subject. That's awful to think of, isn't it? You say, well, I heard this fellow lecture on Poe. Yeah, I know about Poe. I heard this fellow lecture on him. I think that's pitiful. I'd hate to go down history or anywhere as a lecturer on anything. I just would. It just violates my nature. I just can't stand it. Now, don't you tell these fine lecturers here that I said that. They don't care, you see. You can tell them they don't care. Now, I want to talk to you just a minute about Lygia. It's so warm in here, you see, you can't stay awake, even on cold. I didn't get back there to open the door, open the window, or turn off the... Yes, if I could find the thing. 654. I'll tell you what, I won't read any of that. He does the same thing in this. He states his thesis to start with. Would you care to state it?
Well, boy, I can.
Yeah. All you need to know about it. He states his thesis and then gives you an example. He does a little more than that. He does a little.
That was Joe Simonson, and he said the thesis was stated in that quotation at the head of the story, and it was repeated two or three times in the story.
Now, let me tell you a little more that he does, and then you go from there. This story is composed of two parts. The first half of it is an essay on this subject that he, Joe, talked about. And the second part is the example, or the story proper. Now, you see, he has this long essay, and this is what will offend you. Well, both of them will offend you. I think we have gone so far from the conventions, customs of post-time, I think both of them will. That first one, you see, or the second paragraph, there is one dear topic I have on which my memory fails me not. It was the person of Lygia. In stature, she was tall, somewhat slender, and in her latter days, even emaciated. I would in vain attempt to portray the majesty, the quiet ease of her demeanor, or the incomprehensible lightness and elasticity of her footfalls. Now, that won't appeal to you. I know it won't. Yeah.
Of course, that one word, lightness and elasticity, footfall,
the key to the
later.
Yeah, that's the plot proper. That's right. Now he has a discussion of beauty, and he quotes Bacon. I won't read that. Now the next paragraph, her eyes. You see what happened to eyes now. We have no models in the remote antiquity. It might have been, too, that in these eyes, my beloved, lay the secret of the Lord, there were, I must believe, far larger than the ordinary eyes of our own race. They were even fuller than the fullest of the gazelle eyes of the tribe of the valley of Nurjahad. He read the encyclopedias a great deal, Poe did, and he wrote for them a little bit. That little thing about the maelstrom, part of that's based on what the account of it in Encyclopedia Britannica. So I think he's just bringing, I don't think think he never was over there, of course. Yet it was only at, you see, Poe was a scientist. You know that? He wrote a scientific book, and it wrote for the scientific journals. That was the state of science in his time. He wrote a book on shells, technical book, seashells. It was only at intervals and moments of intense excitement that this peculiarity became more than slightly noticeable in Ligeia. And at such moments was her beauty, and my heated fancy thus it is, the beauty of beings, even the beauty of Fabrizuri. The hue of the orbs was the most brilliant of black, and far over them hung jetty lashes of great length. The brows, you see, we would quip about that, whether they were hers or borrowed lashes. The brows, slightly irregular in outline, had the same tint. The strangeness, however, which I found in the eyes was of a nature distinct from the formation, the color. Ah, word of no meaning, behind whose vast latitude of mere sound we entrench our ignorance of so much of the spiritual. The expression of the eyes of Ligeia. How for long hours have I pondered over them. Now that exceeds our interest in the eyes. But now that's not so much Poe's interest, but an interest of his time. And so he goes. Now look at the learning, the intensity. He talks about the intensity of Ligeia. And then I have spoken of the learning of Ligeia. It was immense, such as I have never known in Roman. In the classical tongues was she deeply proficient, and as far as my own acquaintance extended in regard to the modern dialects of Europe, I have never known her at all. She never missed a declension, you see. Indeed, upon my theme of the most, upon any theme of the most admired, most admired, because simply the most abstruse of the boasted erudition of the academy, have I ever found her at fault. How singularly, thrillingly, this one point in the nature of my wife has forced itself this late period upon my attention. I said her knowledge was such as I have never known a woman. But where breathes the man who has traversed and successfully all the wide areas of moral, physical, and mathematical science? I saw not then that what I now clearly perceive, that acquisitions of Ligeia were gigantic, were astounding, yet I was sufficiently aware of her infinite supremacy to resign myself with a childlike confidence to her guidance through the chaotic world of metaphysical investigation. That's clear what he's doing. I don't believe you'll make the jump. You won't make the jump. How much trouble did you have making that little jump in the first 150 pages of Moby Dick? That idea of knights and squires, where very common people in heroic action will be noble. It's rather troublesome. Now you see, it's almost inevitable to think of Hester as one of those dull, cruel, Puritan women. But eventually, you see, that she's something entirely different. And now, with all your fondness for Poe's extraordinary exaggeration in fantasy, with all your fondness for that, you still won't sort of get a hold of it. Related to that same thing Emerson talks about in his time is the interest in the commonplace. And here Poe invests the commonplace. You see, he carries it so far that it's not convincing to you anymore. he carries it commonplace so far. You see, all those great faculties of the commonplace. Now, you see, right now, Eric Hoffer, that old longshoreman out in the Pacific coast, has brought forth an idea that seems so curious. He says, in this time of leisure to come, not only a 40-hour week, but a 30 or 20-hour week, so much time will be left over that the working man, he now gets in his car and just accumulates mileage on his vacations. He doesn't know what else to do. But this plain, common working man will show more of these great faculties that they're talking about. They're just born in him. That's Eric Hoffer, that old, tough, rough-looking longshoreman. So that you see this little point of view from Emerson, they all have it. And it sort of opens up the world for them. They pursue it. And the light that it sheds on so many things is just unmeasurable. And I guess you might say we have 5 minutes left in the course. I wouldn't work with you if I thought you were just going to get a job and get married and go out in the suburbs and enjoy yourself and the pursuit of happiness. I wouldn't spend 5 minutes with you if I thought you were going to do that. If you can't overcome some of these obstacles to the individual and flood yourselves with the immediate age, tear away from all this taxiing, you see, that the housewives have to do. Boys at the office just live under the threat of no promotion, and then they'll lose faith. If you can't tear yourselves loose from that somehow and get free to live in the world. Thoreau had to tear out of it. Hawthorne took 8 years when he finished college to get his mind clear. He just went off by himself to get his mind clear, where he could handle his own mind. Tear away from this best of all possible worlds. Best of all possible worlds. The best thing about this world, as I see it, is that it enables us to come in here and pursue this venture, and there's nowhere else I have found that I can do it. Nowhere else. You see, if I didn't take this seriously, I just practically might as well go bury in the sand. I'd live a perfectly fruitless life with my cows out here in the country. The grass still hadn't grown up much. I'm having to order some more feed.